But we have already spent some time on this subject, and Ed is waiting to take us on to other places of importance in the city. 8. Plans for future work. A short walk brought us to a large rectangular building which, our friend informed us, was the Hall of Science, and my fair companion and I were at a loss to know how science, as we always understood the word on Earth, could have any place in the spirit world. However, we were soon to learn many things, the chief of which was that 49 the Earth world has the spirit world to thank for all the major scientific discoveries that have been made throughout the centuries. The laboratories of the world of spirit are many decades in advance of those of the Earth plane. And it will be years before many revolutionary discoveries are allowed to be sent through to the Earth world, because the Earth has not yet sufficiently progressed. Neither Ruth nor I had any very great leaning towards science and engineering, and Edwin, knowing our taste in this direction, proposed that we should give but a moment or two to this particular hall. In the Hall of Science, every field of scientific and engineering investigation, study, and discovery was covered, and here were to be seen so many of those men whose names have become household words, and who, since passing into spirit, have continued their life's work with their fellow scientists with the full and immense resources of the spirit world at their command. Here they can solve those mysteries that baffled them when they were on Earth. There is no longer any such thing as personal rivalry. Reputations have no more to be made, and the many material handicaps are abandoned forever. It follows that where such a gathering of savants can exist, together with their unlimited resources, the results must be correspondingly great. In the past ages, all the epoch-making discoveries have come from the spirit world. Of himself, incarnate man can do very little. Most people are content to consider the Earth world as sufficient unto itself. Indeed, it is not. The scientist is fundamentally a man of vision, it may be limited, but it is there nevertheless. And our own spirit scientists can, and do, impress their earthly colleagues with the fruits of their investigation. In many cases where two men are working upon the same problem, the one who is in spirit will be far ahead of his confrere who is still on Earth. A hint from the former is very often enough to set the latter upon the right track, and the result is a discovery for the benefit of humanity. In so many cases humanity has so benefited. But, alas, in so many cases humanity has suffered sorrow and tribulation through the devilish perversion of those discoveries. Every one of them that is sent from the spirit world is for the advantage and spiritual progression of man. If perverted minds use those same things for the destruction of man, then Ma has only himself to blame. That is why I affirmed that the Earth world has not spiritually progressed enough to have many more splendid inventions that have already been perfected here. They are ready and waiting, but if they were sent through to the Earth plane in its present state of spiritual mind, they would be misused by unscrupulous people. The people of the Earth have it in their power to see that modern inventions are employed solely for their spiritual and material good. When the time comes that real spiritual progress is made, then the Earth plane can expect a flood of new inventions and discoveries to come through from the scientists and engineers of the spirit world. But the Earth plane has a long and sorrowful way to go before that time comes. And in the meantime, the work of the spirit scientist continues. We in spirit do not require the many inventions of the Earth plane. I think I have sufficiently indicated that our laws are totally different from those of the Earth plane. We have no use for inventions that will increase our speed of travel as with you. Our own method of transit is as rapid as thought, because thought is the motive power. We have no need for methods of saving life, because we are indestructible. We have no need for the hundreds of inventions to make life easier, safer, more comfortable, and enjoyable, because our life is all that, and more than that already. But in this Hall of Science many, many devoted men were working for the betterment of the Earth plane through the medium of their researches, and lamenting that so much could not be given to the Earth because it would not be safe as yet to do so. We were permitted to see the progress that had been made in locomotion, and we were amazed at the advance that had been made since the days when we were on the Earth plane. but that is as nothing to that which is to come. When man exercises his will in the right direction, there will be no end to the enormous rewards that he will gain in material progress, but material progress must go hand in hand with spiritual progress. And until they do, the earth world will not be permitted to have the many inventions that are ready and waiting to be sent through. The generality of people of the earth world are very stubborn. They resent any encroachment on their preserves, or upon what they have presumptuously claimed as their preserves. It was never intended that when the results of our scientists' researches are communicated to the earth, they were to be seized upon by the few to the exclusion of all others. Those that have done so find that they have to pay a very heavy price for their brief span of earthly prosperity. Neither was it intended that the two worlds, ours and yours, should be as they are now, so far apart in thought and contact. The day will assuredly come when our two worlds will be closely interrelated, when communication between the two will be a commonplace of life, and then the great wealth of resources of the spirit world will be open to the earth world, to draw upon for the benefit of the whole human race. The sight of so much activity on the part of my fellow inhabitants of this realm had set my mind to thinking about my own future work and what form it could take. I had no very definite ideas upon the matter, and so I mentioned my difficulty to Edwin. Ruth, it seems, was troubled similarly, so there were the two of us, having, for the first time since our arrival, some small feelings of restlessness. Our old friend was not the least surprised. He would have been more surprised, he said, if we had felt otherwise. It was a sensation common to all, sooner or later, the urge to be doing something useful for the good of others. It was not that we were tired of seeing our own land, but that we had rather a self-conscious feeling. Edwin assured us that we could continue to go upon our explorations indefinitely if we so wished, and that none would criticize or comment upon our actions. It would thus be treated as a matter of our own concern. However, we both felt that we should like to settle the question of our future work, and we appealed accordingly for the guidance of our good friend. Edwin suggested at once that we repair to the borders of the higher realms, where, it will be recalled, he said earlier, we should be able to go into this matter. And so we left the Hall of Science, and once more we found ourselves on the outskirts of our realm. We were taken to a very beautiful house, which from its appearance and situation was clearly of a higher degree than those farther inland. The atmosphere was more rarefied, and as far as I could observe, we were approximately upon the same spot as on our first visit to the boundary. Edwin led us into the house with all the freedom in the world, and bade us welcome. As soon as we entered, I knew instinctively that he was giving us welcome to his own home. Strange to say, we had never inquired about his home or where it was situated. He said he had purposely kept our minds off the subject, but that was only his natural diffidence. Ruth was enchanted with everything she saw, and scolded him for not telling us all about it much sooner. The house was built of stone throughout, and although to the eye it might have appeared somewhat bare, yet friendliness emanated from every corner. Rooms were not large, but of medium size, and suitable for Edwin's purposes. There were plenty of comfortable chairs, many well-lined bookshelves. But it was the general feeling calm and peace that pervaded the whole dwelling that struck us most forcibly. Edwin bade us be seated and make ourselves at home. Then no need for us to hurry, and we could discuss our problem ad in extenso. At the outset I frankly admitted that I had no particular ideas upon what I could do. While on earth I had been fortunate enough to be able to follow my own inclinations, and I had consequently a busy life. But my work was finished, at least in one respect, when my earthly life ended. Edwin then proposed that perhaps I would like to join him in his work, which principally concerned with taking in hand newly arrived souls whose religious beliefs were the same as we had held upon earth, but who, unlike ourselves, were unable as yet to realize the truth of the change they had made, and of the unreality of so much there of religion. Much as I liked my friend's proposal, I did not feel competent enough to undertake such work, but Edwin waved aside my objection. "I should," he said, "work with him, at first at any rate." We had become used to the task. I could continue independently if I so wished. Speaking from experience, Edwin said that two or more people, and here he glanced at Truth, could very often give far greater help to an individual soul than could one work entirely alone. The weight of numbers seemed to have a greater power of conviction upon one who was particularly stubborn in holding on to his old earthly religious ideas. Since Edwin felt that I would be of real service to him, I was very pleased to accept his offer to join forces with him. And here Ruth brought herself forward as another candidate for service under him, subject, of course, to his approval. Not only was the letter instantly forthcoming, but her offer was gratefully accepted. "There was much," said he, "that a young woman could do, and the three of us, work in such complete harmony and amity, should be able to do some useful work together." I was more than glad that Ruth was to join us, since it meant that our happy party would not be broken up. There was, however, another matter that was in my mind. It concerned that one particular book that I wished I had written when I was on Earth. I was not rendered unhappy by thought of this still persisting, but I wanted to be free of it, although, no doubt, my new work would eventually bring me that complete peace of mind. I felt that I would like to deal with the matter in a more direct way. Edwin knew what I was hinting at, and he recalled to me what he had already said about the difficulties of communication with the Earth world. But he had also mentioned that we might seek guidance from higher up. If I still wished to try my hand at communication, then we might appeal for that guidance and advice now, and thus we could settle the whole question of my future work. Edwin then left us and retired into another room. I had hardly been chatting with Ruth for a moment about our new occupation when our old friend returned, bringing with him a very striking-looking man who, I knew at once, had come from a higher sphere in answer to Edwin's call. He did not appear to be one of our own countrymen, and my observation was correct, since he was an Egyptian, as Edwin told us later on. He spoke our own tongue perfectly. Edwin introduced us, and explained my wishes and the possible difficulties of their fulfillment. 52-hour visitor was possessed of a very strong personality, and he gave one the strong impression of calmness and placidity. He would, one imagined, always remain perfectly unruffled. We all seated ourselves comfortably, and Edwin acquainted him with the extent of my knowledge concerning communication with the Earth world. The Egyptian placed some considerations before me. "If," said our visitor, "I was fully determined that by returning to the earth plane to speak I should retrieve the situation that was giving me cause to regret, then he would do everything to assist me to achieve my purpose. It would not be possible to do what I wanted, though, for some years to come. But in the meantime I was to accept his definite assurance that I should eventually be able to communicate, and he made me a promise to that effect. If I would have patience, all should be as I wished. I was to leave the whole matter in the hands of those who had the ordering of these things, and all would be well. The time, to use an earthly term, would soon pass, and the occurrence of certain events, meanwhile, would make the path clear and would provide the requisite opportunity. It must be remembered that what I was asking was not merely to return to the earth plane to endeavor to record the fact that I still lived. What I wanted was to try to undo something that I wished I had never done. And it was a task, I could see, that could not be accomplished in a moment. What I had written I could never unwrite, but I could ease my mind by telling the truth, as I now know it, to those who are still on the earth plane." The kindly Egyptian then rose and we shook hands. He congratulated us on the way we had accustomed ourselves to our conditions of life, wished us joy of our new work whenever it should start, and finally gave me a repeated promise that my own particular wishes should have their certain fulfillment. I tried to express my gratitude for all his help, but he would not hear of it, and with a wave of the hand he was gone. We remained for a discussing our plans. I was looking forward keenly to starting our work. It must not be thought that we were part of a campaign to convert people, in the religious sense in which that word is used on Earth. Far from it. We do not interfere with people's beliefs nor their viewpoints. We only give our services when they ask for in such matters, or when we see that by giving them we can effect some useful purpose. Neither do we spend our time walking about evangelizing people, but when the call comes for help we answer it instantly. But there comes a time when spiritual will make itself felt, and that is the turning point in the life of many a soul who has been confined and restricted by wrong views, whether religious or otherwise. Religion is not responsible for all mistaken ideas. There is a surprising number of people who do not realize they have passed from the earth in the death of a physical body. Resolutely they will not believe that they are what the earth calls dead. They are dimly aware that some sort of change has taken place, but what that change is they are not prepared to say. Some, after a little explanation, and even demonstration, grasp what has actually happened. Others are stubborn, and will be convinced only after prolonged reasoning. In the latter case we are oftentimes obliged to leave such a soul for a while to allow quiet contemplation to work its way. We know we shall be sought out the instant that soul feels the power of our reasoning. In respects it is tiring work, though I use the word tiring strictly limited sense of the spirit world. 53 Ruth and I were both more than grateful to Edwin for his generous help in our affairs, and I was particularly so, both to him and the Egyptian, for the excellent prospect of communicating with the earth world. In view of our decisions to cooperate with Edwin in his work, he made the suggestion that as we had seen a little, but only a very little, of our own realm, we might profitably make a visit to the dark realms. Ruth and I both concurred, adding that we had by now sufficient self-confidence to withstand anything of an unpleasant nature that might befall us. We should, of course, be under the immediate protection and guidance of our old friend. Needless to say that without this we should not have attempted to go, even had we been permitted. We left Edwin's beautiful house, quickly traversed our own realm, and again we were on the borders of the lower realms. Edwin warned us that we should feel that sense of chilling which we experienced before, but that by an effort of will we could throw it off. He placed himself in the middle of us, Ruth and I each taking one of his arms. He turned and looked at us, and was apparently satisfied with what he saw. I glanced at Ruth and I noticed that her robe, as had Edwin's, had taken on a dull color, approaching almost gray. Looking at myself I discovered that my own dress had undergone a similar change. This was certainly perplexing, but our friend explained that this toning down of our natural colors was but the operation of a natural law, and did not mean that we had lost what we had already gained. The practical application of such a law meant that we should not be conspicuous in uncongenial surroundings, nor should we carry the light of our realm into those dark places to blind the vision of those who dwelt there. We were walking along a great tract of barren country. The ground was hard underfoot, the green of trees and grass was gone. The sky was dull and leaden, and the temperature had dropped very considerably, but we could feel an internal warmth that counteracted it. Before us we could see nothing but a great bank of mist that gathered in density as we advanced, until finally we were within it. It swirled round in heavy, damp clouds, and it seemed almost like a dead weight as it pressed upon us. Suddenly a figure loomed out of the mist and came towards us. He was the first person we had met as yet, and recognizing Edwin, he gave him a friendly greeting. Edwin introduced us and told him of our intentions. He said he would like to join us, as perhaps he could be of some help to us, and we readily accepted his kind offer. We resumed our journey, and after a further passage through the mist, we found that it began to clear a little until it vanished altogether. We could now see our surroundings clearly. The landscape was bleak in the extreme, with, here and there, a dwelling house of the meanest order. We came closer to one of the latter, and we were able to examine it better. It was a small, squat house, squarely built, devoid of ornament, and looking altogether thoroughly uninviting. It even had a sinister look in spite of its plainness, and it seemed to repel us from it the nearer we approached it. There was no sign of life to be seen at any of the windows or round about it. There was no garden attached to it, It just stood out by itself, solitary and forlorn. Edwin and our new friend evidently knew both the house and its inmate quite well, for upon going up to the front door, Edwin gave a knock upon it and without waiting for an answer opened it and walked in, beckoning us to follow. We did so and I ourselves in the poorest sort of apology for a house. Their little furniture, and that of the meanest, and at first sight to earthly eyes one would have said that poverty reigned here, and one would have felt the natural sympathy and urge to offer what help one could. But to our spirit eyes the poverty was of the soul, meanness was of the spirit, and although it roused our sympathy it was sympathy of another kind, of which material help is no avail. The coldness seemed almost greater within than without, and we were told that it came from the owner of the house himself. We passed into a back room and met the sole occupant seated in a chair. He made no attempt to rise or give any sign of welcome. Ruth and I remained in the background while the other two went forward to speak to our unwilling host. He was a man just middle years. He had something of an air of faded prosperity. The clothes he wore had been obviously neglected, whether through indifference or other causes, in the light of my earthly recollections I was unable to say. He rather scowled at the two as Edwin brought us forward as new visitors. It was a moment or two before he spoke, and then he railed at us rather incoherent, but we were able to gather that he deemed himself to be suffering under an injustice. Edwin told him in plain terms that he was talking nonsense, because injustice does not exist in the spirit world. A heated argument followed, heated, that is to say, or part of our host, for Edwin was calm and collected, and in truth, wonderfully kind. Many times did the former glance at Truth, whose gentle face seemed to brighten the whole dingy place too, looked at Truth, who held my arm, to see how this strange man was affecting her, but she was unperturbed. At length he quieted down and seemed much more tractable, and then he and Edwin had some private conversation together. At the end of it he told Edwin that he would think about it, that he could call again if he wished and bring his friends with him. Upon this he arose from his chair, escorted us to the door and showed us out. And I observed that he was almost becoming affable, though not quite. It was as if he was reluctant to submit to being pleasant. He stood at his front door watching us as we walked away, until we must have been nearly out of sight. Edwin seemed very pleased with our visit, and then he gave us some particulars of the strange man. He had, he said, been in spirit some years now, but in his life he had been a successful businessman, successful, that is, as far as the earth plane judges such things. He had not thought of much else than his business, and be always considered that any means were justified in gaining his own ends, provided they were legal. He was ruthless in his dealings with all others, and be elevated efficiency to the level of a god. In his home all things, and people, was subservient to him. He gave generously to charity where there was likely to accrue the greatest advantage and credit. He supported his own religion and church with vigor, regularity, and fervor. He felt that he was an ornament to the church, and he was much esteemed by all those connected with it. He added some new portions to the edifice at his own expense, and a chapel was named after him as the donor. But from what Edwin had been able to glean from his story, he had scarcely committed one decent, unselfish action in the whole of his life. His motive was always self-aggrandizement, and he had achieved his purpose on earth at the absolute expense of his life in the spirit world. And now his grievance was that after having lived such an exemplary life, in his own estimation, he should be condemned to live in such comparative squalor. He refused to see that he had condemned himself to it, and that there was none other to blame but himself. He complained that the church had misled him all along, since his munificence had been received in such fashion that he believed his gifts to the church would weigh heavily in his favor in the hereafter. Again he could not see that it is motive that counts, and that a happy state in the spirit world cannot be bought for hard cash. A small service willingly and generously performed for a fellow mortal builds a greater edifice in spirit to the glory of God than do large sums of money expended upon ecclesiastical bricks and mortar erected to the glory of man, with full emphasis upon the donor. This man's present mood was anger, which was all the greater because he had never been denied anything whilst upon the earth. He had never been accustomed to such degrading circumstances as those at present. His difficulties were increased by the fact that he did not know quite whom to blame. Expecting a high reward, he had been cast into the depths. He had made no real friends. There seemed to be no one, of his own social position, he said, who could advise him in the matter. Edwin had tried to reason with him, but he was in an unreasoning frame of mind, and had been so for some long time. He had had few visitors because he repelled them, and although Edwin had made many visits to him, the result was always the same, a stolid adherence to his sense of injustice. Upon Edwin's latest call, in company with Ruth and myself and with the friend whom we had met on the way, there were distinct symptoms of a coming change. They were not manifest first, but as our visit drew to a close he had shown signs of relenting from his stubborn attitude. And Edwin was sure that it due as much to Ruth's softening presence as to his own powers reasoning with him. He felt sure, too, that were we to return him on our way back, we should find him in a different frame of mind altogether. He would be unwilling to admit too soon that the fault was his entirely, but perseverance will work wonders. Ruth was naturally pleased that she had been able to be of service so quickly, though she disavowed any claim to have done anything but merely stand there as an observer. Edwin, however, at once pointed out to her that while she disclaimed any action in external order, she had shown a real sympathy and sorrow for this unhappy man. That explained his frequent glances at her. He had felt that commiseration, and it had done him good although he was unaware of the cause of it. And here Ruth begs me to add that her very small share would have been of little in this man's recovery had it not been for Edwin's long unceasing work on his behalf. This was our first encounter with unfortunates of the lower spheres, and I have been somewhat protracted in giving details of it. It was, in many respects, straightforward by comparison what we met later, and in recounting it I have done so because it was an introduction to our future work. For the present, however, it was not intended that we should do anything but make observations of the dark realms. The four of us resumed our journey. There were no paths to follow, and the ground was becoming decidedly rocky in formation. The light was rapidly diminishing from a sky that was heavy and black. There was not a soul, not a house, nor any sign of life to be seen. The whole district seemed colorless and empty, and we might have been wandering in another world. We could dimly ahead of us, after the passage of some time, something which had the appearance of dwellings, and we moved there in direction. The terrain was now rocks and nothing else, and here we could see people seated with their heads down, seem almost lifeless, but in reality, in the depths of gloom and despair they took no notice of us whatever as we passed them, and soon we drew level with the dwellings we had viewed distantly. 56. 9. The dark realms at close view it became clear that these dwellings were nothing more than mere hovels. They were distressing to gaze upon, but it was infinitely more distressing to contemplate that these were the fruits of men's lives upon earth. We did not enter any of the shacks, it was repulsive enough outside, and we could have served no useful purpose at present by going in. Edwin therefore gave us a few details instead. Some of the inhabitants, he said, had lived here, or hereabouts, year after year, as time is reckoned upon earth. They themselves had no sense of time, and their existence had been one interminable continuity of darkness through no one's fault but their own. Many had been the good souls who had penetrated into these Stygian realms to try to effect a rescue out of the darkness. Some had been successful, others had not. Success depends not so much upon the rescuer as upon the rescued. If the latter shows no glimmer of light in his mind, no desire to take a step forward on the spiritual road, then nothing, literally nothing, can be done. The urge must come from within the fallen soul himself. And how low some of them had fallen! Never must it be supposed that those who, in the earth's judgment, had failed spiritually, are fallen low. Many such have not failed at all, but are, in point of fact, worthy souls whose fine reward awaits them here.